Chapter 17. Cogan's Last Stand. Chuck Cogan had come of age in the CIA in the 1960s, long before Congress demanded or even claimed the right to serve as its watchdog. By the time Cogan had climbed to the top of the agency, he had not found it easy to adapt to the idea of politicians intruding into this private world. But he was a good soldier, and ever since the law establishing intelligence oversight committees was enacted in 1980, he had done his part to brief members and staff on the House and Senate side. Cogan had drawn the line, however, when Wilson had moved to insinuate himself into the operational details of the agency's business. In his quasi-military world, Cogan enjoyed the status of a 3-star general. He didn't just oversee the Afghan operation. He had to deal with the hostage nightmare, with Khomeini, with Saddam Hussein, with the spread of nuclear weapons, and on and on. This was no playground for amateurs. He had been quite upfront in telling Wilson that the agency would not go along with his request to fund the Charlie Horse. The whole idea of an Israeli anti-aircraft gun for a Muslim jihad was absurd. Nor was he going to permit any non-Soviet weapons into Afghanistan. Wilson's response had been crude, almost threatening, but the CIA veteran had assumed that this was just congressional bluster. The fact was that Wilson had been trespassing in areas where he did not belong, and Cogan had politely shown him the door. No doubt Cogan would have been happy never to see Charlie Wilson. Unlike his colleagues and predecessors, however, Wilson did not accept Cogan's implied premise that the CIA had an exclusive right to decide the nature of this war. Things may have worked that way before, but Wilson had decided to change all that. It was really quite simple as he saw it. Congress not only represented a co-equal branch of the U.S. government, it had the power of the purse. The bill he had muscled through called on the CIA to spend $17 million for Swiss anti-aircraft cannon, as well as another $23 million to be left to the CIA's discretion, to be deployed in a campaign that everyone knew the president enthusiastically endorsed. Just to be sure the CIA got the message, Wilson had included language obligating it to inform him in advance of how it intended to spend the balance of the $40 million appropriation he had sponsored. And so, when the congressman requested a meeting, the agency found itself with no real choice but to send Chuck Cogan back to try to sort things out. The way Wilson saw it, the CIA basically woke up one morning to discover they had an extra $40 million they hadn't asked for. It was kind of a good-news, bad-news deal. Good because they like money. Bad because it specified that the money should be used for an anti-aircraft cannon they didn't want. But then a lot more money for the things they did want. Boots, morphine, and saws to cut off legs and arms. They had to come and clear it first. Left with the unpleasant task of returning to Wilson's office to try to reason with the congressman, Cogan again tapped Avrakatos. As the two men moved through the cavernous white marble halls of the Rayburn office building, Cogan, with the slightly thuggish-looking Avrakatos by his side, was still convinced that he would be able to put this meddling congressman back in his cage, but best, he thought, to wear the man down with good arguments. Wilson received Cogan and Avrakatos at his desk, next to the giant map of the world that covered an entire wall of his office. He was all business, interested only in hearing when the guns would be deployed. Unfortunately, the division chief had some bad news. Preliminary studies indicated that the Oerlikon was simply too heavy for the Afghans to carry up to the heights where it could be useful. An even bigger problem, he explained, were the shells. So many would be needed that scores of mules would have to be provided. The agency would end up having to go into the mule business. Wilson recalls Cogan suggesting that as many as 200 of these pack animals might be needed just to take care of one Oerlikon over the course of a year. Cogan stressed the top-secret nature of the briefing. Another congressman might have been intimidated, but Wilson had been studying the Jaynes series of weapons reference books, as well as conferring with his own arms expert, Ed Lutwick. He knew that the agency was already giving the Mujahideen Soviet 14.5mm machine guns, which weighed more than the Oerlikon. So what was the big deal about his guns? Cogan shifted gears. End-user certificates were a big problem. The Swiss, with their fetish for neutrality, would be compromised if the Soviets cornered them and demanded to know who had paid for the guns. The U.S. cover would be blown. It could have nightmarish ramifications, he confided. It would require finding a government willing to lie for the CIA and assume responsibility for the Ehrlichans. Wilson found this argument empty. With 20,000 employees, the CIA should be able to take care of a simple concealment program. Kogan was clearly feeding him a lot of sludge, and he didn't like it. He was demanding a specific answer, and Kogan didn't want to tell him outright that he wasn't going to buy the guns. "Well, how about the $4 million we put in for boots?" Wilson asked with contempt. "There hasn't been one damn boot delivered, and I understand there were 82 cases of frostbite last week. Do you need end-user certificates to send boots, Mr. Coburn?" Avrakatos, meanwhile, sat quietly, fascinated by the spectacle of this congressman viciously reaming his boss, whom everyone else treated with such reverence. Over the course of the next few months, while Kogan stonewalled him, Charlie would come to hold him personally responsible for the slaughter that continued in the mountains. "The only thing I care about, Coburn," he said at the end of that meeting, "is shooting down those helicopters, and I don't care if it hurts your feelings or not. There is nothing I won't do, absolutely nothing." While Wilson was doing battle with Kogan, Joanne Herring was in a state. All of her grand plans were suddenly in jeopardy. She had organized a party that was designed to put her and her political salon on the map, but to her horror, most of the important people she had been counting on were turning her down. The party was billed as a Welcome to Washington dinner for Prince Bandar, the dashing young American-trained fighter pilot serving as Saudi ambassador to the United States. Joanne had known Bandar ever since his flight training in Texas, when he'd attended her extravaganzas in River Oaks. Since then, the prince had married King Fahd's daughter and become, for all intents and purposes, a surrogate son of the Saudi monarch. "I just assumed that because of his history everyone would accept," recalls Joanne. That assumption would have been sound had she given the party a couple of years later, when Bandar emerged as the most powerful and influential ambassador since World War II. In those days, however, Bandar's most impressive accomplishments stemmed from his work in the shadows. Just a few months after Joanne's invitation, Ronald Reagan's national security advisor, Robert C. McFarlane, would visit Bandar at his palatial house overlooking the Potomac to ask the Saudi prince to secretly fund the Contras. Bandar would quickly win approval from the throne to pay $1 million a month to keep the CIA's Contras in the field. Soon enough, Bandar's many discreet favors for the American government would raise his profile with Washington's power elite. George Bush would take the prince and his family on fishing vacations. Colin Powell would come over to his house to play handball. Indeed, during the Gulf War, Bandar would become a de facto member of the National Security Council. But back in early 1984, his name was not working for Joanne. It was all doubly embarrassing because she had taken Charlie to lunch at the prince's house, where she had gone over the guest list and promised a party to end all parties. As always, she was mixing pleasure with business. By this time, thoughts of marriage to Charlie had passed, but Joanne was as deeply committed to their common crusade for Zia and the Afghans as ever, and she knew that few men in Washington could be as helpful to Charlie as the young ambassador. It was a tightly held secret, but Wilson knew from classified briefings that the Saudis were secret partners of the CIA in the Afghan War, and he was eager to meet Bandar. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan had an even more dramatic impact on the Desert Kingdom than it had on America. The Saudis sit on at least one-third of the world's known oil reserves, perhaps the greatest treasure trove any nation has ever possessed. But the 870,000-square-mile kingdom, with a population not much greater than that of Los Angeles County, has no real army to protect its wealth. The royal family was convinced that once the Red Army invaded Afghanistan and took up positions a few hundred miles from the kingdom, the Kremlin's grand design would call for moving on their oil fields next. In Washington, shortly after the invasion, Jimmy Carter had announced the creation of a rapid deployment force and committed the United States to protecting Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf oil states from any aggression. For their part, the Saudis had moved to turn their country, in effect, into a forward base for American military forces. They'd commenced building vast underground facilities where weapons and ammunition could be prepositioned for an American-led intervention. They'd built airfields with hardened hangars able to withstand 2,000-pound bombs, erecting hundreds more than were needed for their own air force, making it possible for the United States to fly in naked and be instantly ready for war. Fuel and bombs and bullets and food had all been placed in storage for the day when they might be needed for an American rescue mission.